Adopted.
I'll move the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Minutes are approved. Representative Junkie. Representative House, will you move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1367 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
And Madam Chair, there is an amendment there too. With Representative Faust would move the A4 to get the bill in the condition I'd like to have it.
Representative Faust, would you do that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A4 amendment.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion to bail.
And Madam Chair, I think we're, I know there's speakers listed here. I'm just going to bring down Mr. Power right now. He maybe can do it all. I don't know if anyone else needs to speak or not. We'll start with him and see who else wants to weigh in later. But basically, members, this bill is the result of a noxious weed task force that we set up some time back to look at and redo our noxious weed laws. And I'll let Mr. Power explain that. The amendment you put on was mine. It basically, on the back, 2.17 adds a local soil and water conservation district person, as opposed to just the Bowser person, which is number 14 in the bill. You'll see now that we also have a local representative rather than just a state representative. So it did that. Remove the repealer. We were repealing for some reason in this bill language that really is the heart of the noxious weed law. So I'm not sure why that got in there that way. And then it also clarifies, as opposed to the other bill, that the counties have an option in this to either or to appoint a county weed inspector or a designated person if they don't want to do a weed inspector. And then that becomes the point person in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture, who really should maintain the expertise on this. And actually, we asked the department to maintain these laws and other things on their website, which isn't a problem either. So it was really a correction, technical kind of amendment, but it clarified a few things, particularly for the county. And we can go into that more detail. I guess at this time, I'd ask Tim Power to give a brief overview on what their committee did when they met and some of the main pieces of this bill that is before you.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Tim Power. I am a shade tree grower from Hastings and also the past president of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I was one of the 12 groups that were asked to join together by the Department of Agriculture to review the then current noxious weed law. We addressed a number of issues and came to consensus on many of the changes that you see before you in today's bill. My main reason for testifying today is that I wanted to ensure to you that the nursery and landscape industry are very interested in seeing this bill become law. There are things about the current way the bill is structured and the lack of enforcement that currently is in existence that have made it problematic for us, both as people with weed control issues of our own and an industry that was in fact part of the problem on things like buckthorn and purple loosestrife. We wanted to see a scientific process and a review panel on all of the weeds that we have talked about and should talk about in the future so that we can justify our position in the industry based on the results of this scientific commission that we think will have come with better conclusions than something that comes out of the political process. I would be happy to answer questions about the process we went through in 2007. We also have Susan Shaw, the Managing Director of the Soil and Water Conservation District in Mille Lacs, if anybody has questions around those issues. If not, thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions? Comments? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
And again, Madam Chair, maybe I can just remind people of the noxious weed law in general. And basically, we have noxious weed laws here in almost every state in the union. It's old law and good law. Basically, what this bill is going to do is clarify the law. For those of you that don't know, a local government, municipality, whether it's a township or a city, has ultimate responsibility if there's a complaint or to do inspections on the list of noxious weeds in the state. Should they fail to do that, a resident of the state can then work their way up the food chain, and the county is actually the next stop and the overseer of the local municipalities in that. And that's really the only involvement a county would have, is if the local government fails to answer a call for an inspection or a control measure. And the counties then can actually charge back to a local municipality on what they do. The counties, I think rightly so, express that in some counties they might only get two or three calls a year for a county weed inspector, and they ask that they not have to designate someone. Some counties will yet. Some will. There's only one county that has a full-time person. I think it's Hennepin County. Every other county, it's part of their job description. They'll be a quarter-time or a half-time or an eighth-time, whatever. And they ask that they have another designated person to do that if they don't want to do a county weed inspector. And judging from the load that they have, that's probably makes sense in a lot of cases. But then we've asked, and they've asked, that if they do a designee, say the county engineer who does roads becomes the de facto designee for this law, then they have the opportunity to work in consultation and conjunction with the Department of Agriculture, who obviously would be the experts in this, whether it's weed ID or the laws of the land or who gets billed or how we go about enforcement measures. And that way they don't have to spend a lot of time in training or a lot of unfunded dollars in the county if they don't want to, because they have someone to work with on this. So we think at this point it's a very good, workable law. We're also asking, the reason it's going to local government is for that task force on the back, or on the, not the back, but on the second to the last page. They're going to look at the task force provision. The amendment also asks that this task force, then newly appointed, report back within a year. So we have an updated noxious weed list, and then from that point on, they have to report back at least every 3 years with upgraded science and lists and other things. So again, members, we think it was worked out with everyone. We think this is a good way to go moving forward, and hopefully become the law of the land.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, the bill talks about weed inspections on public land and so forth. Does that include like the patchwork of government-owned land that we have in the farming zones that are either DNR-owned or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service? And if so, do the local weed inspectors have the authority then to move on that land and control those weeds and then bill the public agency?
Madam Chair, and there's others obviously in the audience that can explain better. My understanding of the noxious weed law is they would have ultimate control, the municipality, and they would give notice to whoever is in violation to control those noxious weeds within a certain amount of time. Failing to do that, they can then get them controlled themselves and bill them back, is how the law is supposed to work. So obviously you want to give a landowner the opportunity to do it, and usually it's a month or two or whatever. You know, you can't go out and do it immediately for some of these folks. But and again, and but it's up to the local unit to do those inspections. And frankly, we've got a lot of CRP land and other things that aren't necessarily always complied with like they should be, with the landowner who has agreed actually to keep a lot of those noxious weeds out of there as part of their contract. So truly, unless there's a complaint called in by a neighbor or someone else, a lot of times the weed inspectors won't be out there just doing it on their own.
Any other questions? If not,
Madam Chair, are the other testifiers coming up as well?
Madam Chair, they were all happy not to come up unless you had questions.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Johnson, my only question would be if the Department of Agriculture and also the Association of Minnesota Counties would just like to testify saying that they're in support of the bill, or at least neutral.
Anyone who wants to come down and support my bill, I'd be happy to hear from them. But if they're against it, we just certainly say it. No.
State your name for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Ryan O'Connor from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Good afternoon to all of you today. And I think Representative Junkie did an outstanding job of describing the bill, a very complex undertaking with the task force and trying to incorporate all of the disparate interests and attempts at trying to get everything right. There is one point of note that came to counties after getting to read the amendment only a few hours ago that we wanted to raise, and that was only that on lines 2.22 through 2.24, if we want to follow, I believe, the intent of the bill author.
In the bill, not on the amendment.
Excuse
right?
me, I'm sorry. In the bill. If we were to include the designation of a designated county employee within that inspector designation, I think that would forego many the attempt at delineating an inspector versus a county designee. And so that was the only point of note that counties would like to raise. Other than that, we thank the bill author for having accommodated the county's request.
And Madam Chair, I'm asking council to make that correction. I don't think we had a designee in there. We still have just county ag inspector, and again, to the county's deference, we want to have them have the opportunity to do either or, and so we should probably list that out in there too, but maybe it is in another definition. Hang tight. Colby.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, the A4 amendment does add on line 2.23 after ag inspector or other designated county employee. The intent was that, the understanding was that the county could have an agricultural inspector or could appoint another county employee to handle the same duties, so that new county employee, if it wasn't an agricultural inspector, would need to be included as an inspector to carry out the county's obligations.
So, Madam Chair, the official title would still be inspector, but they're allowed to appoint whoever they want into that position. We can work on it. I mean, we have two more committee stops, we'll clarify that.
Other than that, clarification
is covered.
Okay. Representative Bowes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I noticed, first of all, there's no state money in here, but yet there's a grant program. So I'm wondering where the money is coming for the grant program.
Where are you looking?
I'm actually looking on the bill summary.
So we'll give you a section on that bill summary.
26.
Maybe research can help with that too.
Madam Chair and Representative House, if I understand your question, there is no appropriation. There's an account established to hold the donations and future appropriations, and there's a protocol set up to award grants. Should there be money appropriated to that account? But in this bill, there is no appropriation.
Okay. And Representative Fowles, that's done right above in Section 25.
Okay.
We establish an account and hold that in the department either for appropriations in the future, which we're not doing this year, or again, as Council said, for any monies that might come from other sources for this specific use.
Thank you.
Representative Dostowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, Section 13 of the bill, page 4, 4.27 through 4.36, talks about noxious weed designation, creation of new noxious weeds, etc. How does that differ from the way that the department develops and redevelops its list currently?
We can bring the department down to answer that, or someone else from the Mr. Power and others abandoned me up here. I thought they'd hang out for a while. I know we're setting up by Representative Drazkowski a new way to do it. Just how they currently do it, I'm not sure.
That's probably the problem.
Thank you. State your name for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Drake. I'm the Assistant Director of the Plant Protection Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Your question then on the difference. There currently is the current method does not have the committee actively meeting, and so now we have an active committee that will review, and there's a requirement for review every 3 years. So the law can be changed, or the list can be added to on the strength of the active participation of the committee.
And Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think that was the gist and part of the reason the task force met, is these lists aren't being updated like they maybe should be because of limited resources and other things at the department, when certainly we know weeds come and go, frankly, off these lists, depending on their importance or what we see in neighboring states or other things or moving in. So we're hopeful that this committee is named. We'll take an active role. We'll use science and latest weed science and technology to bring that to the table. And at least every 3 years, and the commissioner can call them together sooner than that or more often than that if need be, but at least every 3 years then we get an updated list. You know, do we want to still keep spraying Canadian thistle or not? You know, be a classic example on there.
Any other questions? Comments? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Representative Junkie, I've got kind of the same concern or question that Representative Szymanski did. Currently, if you've got DNR land next to where you're at, it's right now plumb full of noxious weeds. And no matter where you go in the state, I would guess, at least all of the state-owned land that I have been across has not had any control on it. The biggest concern I've heard from people, from farmers and others, is we've got the private people out there, the farmers, controlling their noxious weeds according to law, and then we've got state government continuing to inoculate their land with noxious weeds after they remove them. And, you know, I'm still trying to understand all of the bill. I understand that there's a fund created and the state would get involved if the local process breaks down. But I would like to see, and maybe that's separate from your bill, I don't know, but, you know, we continue to put more and more mandates on farmers and on landowners, and at the same time the state's not doing its job. At what point are we going in the wrong direction here? I guess it's kind of a question. Maybe I'm sharing some frustrations of some of the farmers that I've talked to.
And I'd ask maybe the department wants to comment on that, how they would handle a complaint. You know, there's actually two situations. Number one would be an easement that's been agreed to by a farmer or landowner, whether it's RIM or anything else. And at that point, I would guess that the contracted easement would specify who controls, and it's probably the current landowner, just like it is with CRP and other things. And then your question is a good one. What if it is state-owned land, owned by us, and managed by the DNR or others? If I call in, I guess I'm going to ask him right now as long as he's sitting here, if I call in as an adjacent landowner and say there's a huge Canadian thistle sitting out on that adjacent DNR land, it's creeping into my farm fields and other things, what would you do to effectively control that or see that it's controlled on state-owned land?
Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Junkie, in answer to your question, a lot of what we would do would depend on the time of year. If the weed had gone to seed, for instance, and there was no possibility of control in that particular environmental situation, we would instigate a plan to develop information about how and when was most effectively treated forward that plan. I have to tell you that I'm not sure, and I would have to get back to you on the mechanism of how we would forward that information to the landowners if they were in this case the DNR. We don't have a point of contact that I'm aware of.
But again, Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, it doesn't relieve them of the duty to control it. And so that's That's the main thing. And frankly, none of this works unless, frankly, a complaint comes in from someone, generally speaking. Typically, our weed inspectors aren't driving up and down the township roads looking themselves. Some might, not everyone, though, and mostly it's a complaint-driven thing by an adjacent landowner that sees it and has a problem with it.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, just a quick one. Does this have a fiscal impact for the MDA?
Madam Chair, we don't think so, but that's why it's coming to my committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 1367, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
I guess we have to hold off a minute. Someone else would like to testify. Susan Shaw. Sorry about that.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, my name is Susan Shaw. I'm an employee of the Mille Lacs Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm here to testify in favor of this, representing the task force that met. I did sit on the task force that did a lot of work on this bill, in which there was great consensus that it's a good bill. And one of the things, to answer some of the questions that were brought up, Madam Chair, I might be able to help with that, and want to iterate the key importance of having a designated county appointed weed inspector and how that really can function to help even with a question you had raised about the DNR land. I can speak as a county ag inspector to how it can function on a local level when it's administered that way. One of the things that happens and makes the functionality so great is the ability to work at the local level and make those local level contacts. And so when you have that direct contact with the manager of that state land, for example, you could work out things such as a cooperative weed agreement or a cooperative weed management area. And those are two things that are in this bill that are great tools to help satisfy that need on state lands.
Any other questions? Carmen? Any other testifiers?
Good afternoon.
State your name for the tape.
Peter Schutrup, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Ag Inspectors. And I wanted to let the committee know that the all the work that's been done thus far has been appreciated on this bill, and we are in full support of current proposal. If you have any questions of anything as far as what we do with this as the Ag Inspector community.
Any questions? Comments?
And again, Madam Chair, as you can see with the Ag Inspectors and all the others, we do appreciate the work because it wasn't an easy process, and they all worked through it quite well. And to come to an agreement on this, I know for those of you that were around a couple of years ago, this got very contentious, and that's when we set up the task force and said, please, go away and figure this out, and they did. And so I'm pleased that they brought it back in this form, and as you can see, they're all kind of in agreement here now that this is the way to move forward.
Thank you. Representative Felski. Excuse me. Representative Felski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenkraut? I didn't write it down. But anyway, I was curious and trying to understand the bill better. Can you tell us just briefly how your role is going to be different under this law, assuming it's adopted, relative to what it is now?
It would give us some of those tools that we were talking about with the CMWAs. It actually brings the Department of Ag back into the weed law and as a managing partner, which we have been without since 2003 when the law was changed back then. All around general purpose, it's a good deal. We're seeing our ag inspector community has worked well without it, but with the state being out of the loop, it creates a big vacuum and a hole that it's a better managing tool if we're all working together on this, more efficient.
And Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, one of the things that a couple of testifiers have alluded to are 3.14 to 3.19. It's that cooperative weed control agreement, and we can use that on state lands too. And instead of coming in and just saying, do it by tomorrow or we're going to punish you, et cetera, they can now sit down and say, let's work out a plan over the next 2 or 3 years on how you're going to actively control this. And then you can see if they fail to do it at the end, obviously, then notice can be served and more punishment can be doled out or someone else can do it. But that tool alone, I think, will help the weed inspectors really, whether it's an individual farmer or whether it's the state, sit down and give them the opportunity then to really put together a nice management plan that they can work with without being very punitive if they can.
It would help with the concern that was raised earlier with, say, a DNR property. This gives us an opportunity to sit down at the table and say, this is what we need to do. We know we have restricted funds. Everybody does. But that plan can be laid out, and we can do a reasonable control in a reasonable amount of time and not put fiscal constraints on everybody about that. The other thing that this law will help us all do is current law doesn't allow us to bring in outside money from, say, federal level funding. And there's that, we need that tool at the state level to get those funds when they become available.
Any other questions? If not, Representative Paul, do you want to leave?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will once again renew my motion that House File 1367 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Faust, would you move?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1886 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
And Madam Chair, I'm going to bring down Tony Manns, who will testify on behalf of the bill. This came to me actually from Senator Vickerman over in the Senate, introduced it there, and I introduced it in the House so we'd have a companion. I think it's a good idea. Obviously, we have to go to local government again because there's a task force, and then we'll ultimately go to my committee with it to look and see if there's a cost, the commissioner for this, and if it is, how we address it. But just to give you the general overview of the bill, I'd like Mr. Manns here to explain it to you.
State your name for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Tony Manns. I'm the Director of Food Sourcing for Second Harvest Heartlands. Newell Searle is the individual who normally would testify in these events, but he sends his regards from the sunny beaches of Mexico today. Second Harvest Heartland is one of six Feeding America regional food banks in Minnesota. We act collaboratively to serve the entire state of Minnesota. This proposal would enable producers and hungry charities to gather production information, determine and develop recommendations that could enable producers to make tax-deductible donations of produce and livestock. It is not surprising that the current economic crisis has cost tens of thousands of Minnesotans their jobs, their savings, in many cases, their homes. The state's 300 food shelves have seen 25% and 30% increases in numbers and are seeking help in getting more food. In fact, I have with me a headline from the recent Annandale Advocate. As you can see, it says, food shelves face uphill climb, but the need is growing. Thousands more are visiting hot meal programs at Lowe's and Fish's, Salvation Army, and other locations. Second Harvest Heartland and its sister food banks are the suppliers of these vital hunger charities. Along with the University Food Industry Center, we just recently released a statewide study that estimates that low-income Minnesotans miss an average of 14 meals each month. That's equal to skipping supper 2 weeks every month. How to fill this meal gap? Corporate food processors, the USDA surplus commodities, and local food drives provide significant sources of food. But there are still many untapped food resources going to waste in the form of fruits and vegetables that are not harvested, and contract livestock, hogs and poultry that are perhaps a little bit out of spec, that are not processed. This proposal would establish a task force of producers and food banks to gather information and make recommendations to the chairs of the House and Senate Agriculture Committees concerning the volume of excess, but yet very much usable, crops and livestock that could be donated to hunger charities. This approach is already operating in a number of other states, including Michigan, Texas, Ohio, California, and New York. Second Harvest Heartland is currently interviewing clients of food shelves and soup kitchens to determine their current situation and their level of hunger. I personally have participated in 12 of those interviews, and the question that disturbs me the most is the question that asks, have you ever missed a meal because you didn't have enough money to buy food? Out of 6 of the 12 people I've interviewed, the answer was yes. I ask for your support in this bill to help on the behalf of these 6 people and all struggling Minnesotans. I ask for your help in supporting this bill to help feed them.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just to add to that, a lot of these groups already do some of this, but we think a more coordinated, focused effort by a task force will enhance that. I can give you an example. I used to work at the Del Monte canning factory when I was a youth, and we packaged something called Argo peas, and we did Del Monte sweet peas. And the Argo, you'd run the peas through a water slide, and basically the big marble-heavy Argo peas would sink down to the bottom, and the little light sweet Del Monte peas would float on top, and that's how you canned one or the other. At times, there'd be a mistake made or whatever, and you might be putting the Argo peas into the Del Monte cans. Well, you know, you might run 100 cases of that before you'd shut the line down and make the switch. And now, in the past, a lot of times those peas would just get thrown out in the garbage. When they're perfectly good, they just need to be relabeled or specified that they were rejects from a factory but are in perfectly good condition to eat. So, I mean, that's just one small example. And you know, from the apple growers to the pork folks to the truckers, these are all people that handle this food every single day, and they probably have ideas on how we can utilize what typically might be going now into a waste stream for folks that really need it in our food shelves all around the state. So we think it's a good positive move by the Ag Committee to address that, similar how we address now putting fresh milk into the food shelves. I think it's a good role for us to play, and it does give agriculture a good name to be behind some of this stuff.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You purchase some food, too, as well, don't you?
Madam Chair, representative of the committee, we purchase a limited amount of food, but much of what we redistribute at Second Harvest Heartland is the surplus or food that's not marketable, but yet still is fit for consumption.
Okay, Madam Chair?
Representative Erdahl.
About what percent is donated, then?
I would... Just off the top of my head, I would estimate about 90% of what we distribute is donated.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I imagine that you get a lot of vegetables and fruits donated. Do you know of anyone that donates fruit to Second Harvest?
Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, we did have a very positive experience last fall with the apple harvest. It was a bumper apple crop. And through the efforts of some volunteers that picked the apples and just apple growers that just donated outright, we were able to capture 125,000 pounds, which is the equivalent of 3 entire truckloads of fresh Minnesota apples, and distribute those to needy people. So we have had some experience in it, but yet we really want to take that and expand it much, make it much, much bigger.
Representative
Erdahl. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was setting up on a tee. If Representative Szymanski doesn't want to take any credit for it, it's up to him. But
yeah. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Manns, you know, I was proud to see the apple growers step up last fall and you know, make the donations, because as apple growers, you know, we know how much in an orchard can go to waste if you don't have timely harvest, and really the critical thing is having those volunteers to come out and do the harvest, you know, at the appropriate time and in the appropriate manner. But I have a couple of questions regarding the bill itself here.
Mm-hmm.
You'd referenced several states that already have committees somewhat of this nature. My question is, do they all have, you know, 16 different representatives, or have you looked at the committee structure in some of these other states?
I personally have not. But I know that we've had some graduate students from the University of Minnesota look at it, and I can get you more information on that if you're interested.
All right. Thank you. No further questions at this time.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and a comment here. You know, you're talking about animal protein and stuff like that as well. There's been a big push that any downer animals or an animal that's fatigued or something like that, if it's injured on the truck, it cannot go and be processed for human consumption. Mm-hmm. And even though you go back a generation or two, those were the animals that grandpa or uncle or whomever took home and we butchered them for ourselves and they ended up in our freezers, but yet they just have to be tanked. And I'd just like to maybe get a comment from you as well. I wonder how many people we could feed with those animals instead of just tanking them, because again, it's still safe. The meat is still of good quality, and we could feed many, many hungry people if those laws were taken a look at once again. So just a comment, and maybe if you'd like to respond.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, that certainly is a significant source of much-needed protein for hungry people. However, food safety is very important to us at Second Harvest, and we do also need to follow the USDA and all those guidelines as well. So as long as it's fit for consumption and been approved by all the appropriate health departments, we would love to be able to distribute those products.
Any other questions? Representative Dostoevsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mans, it sounds like the work of Second Harvest has been, I mean, you've had a lot of success with the apple growers and some other groups. I'm curious, is there anything precluding you from working directly with these groups without government's involvement? It sounds like things are going well, and you've actually grown in your outreach to these groups and connection of them to your food shelf efforts. Do we really need to have another government bureaucracy or task force formed in order to do this?
Madam Chair and Representative Jaskowski, that's a very good question. As long as we've had some successes, we still come up with many barriers as well. We have growers that say, well, I it's important, I want to make sure that you get the product, but I don't want to incur any cost for transportation, harvesting, whatever it is. And we have limited funding to support that, and so our hope is that we can have a private-public partnership using either a funding source or a tax credit, enhanced tax credit source, something to that effect, to further entice individuals like that to donate to us. We still do get, while we have had some successes, we do get quite a few objections raised. Primarily, they don't want to incur additional costs on their part.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question for the author of the bill, Representative Junkie. As far as, you know, following up on Representative Draskowski's question with the administrative support, do we know what this may cost the agency if they're going to provide the staff and so forth?
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, we should have a good idea once it gets to my committee, because we've done this in the past with other groups. But we're going to have a fiscal note come from the agency on it over the next couple of weeks before we put our bill together, so we can address that.
One last question, Madam
Representative Szymanski.
And this would go back to Mr. Mans as well. With perishable fruit and products, timing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, I've donated, fruit to our local food shelf as well. And, and I know when my crop is going to be ready and when I, used all of it that I can use and would like to donate the balance of it. We have to be able to call someone, and within 2, 3, 4 days at the most, have a crew come out and harvest the fruit. Is this something that you anticipate this committee will help address that type of issue as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Szymanski, yes, that is something that would be part of the overall effort. The gleaning process of having volunteers come out is certainly one tool to help capture that fruit. And we, to your effect, we do some of that at Second Harvest Heartland, but yet there's some of the other opportunities that we're missing because we can't overcome the obstacles generally on a financial point of view, but we are expanding our efforts that volunteers should capture those apples.
Representative Maskey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last follow-up mm-hmm. question. I hope I don't nitpick this too much, but the other portion of it is storage capacity at the food shelves themselves. You know, when we deliver fresh fruit, the produce, they've either got to have coolers or a volunteer or some location where they can store this product, because they, from my experience with my local food shelf, they don't have a lot of refrigerator space, so they need storage space, and I hope this committee would look at those issues as well.
Madam Chair and Representative Szymanski, that's an also very valid point, and that is really the role that we play as a food bank. We have a large walk-in freezer, and we also partner with the five other food banks in Minnesota. We can bring it in by the truckloads and by the pallets, and generally they're in 40-pound boxes. We distribute them by the box to the food shelf as they need them. So we do play the role of storage facility, and so that we can provide a steady supply to them as they can take it.
Representative Krasowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow Mr. Manns, and thank you for your testimony today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to discern exactly what it is that this task force will do. I've heard it mentioned that connection to financial resources. Are you expecting then that this would somehow open a door for state resources to somehow fund some of these things? Is that what I'm hearing, or?
Madam Chair and Representative, what we're really trying to accomplish is to get all the stakeholders together to find out what objections there are, whether it's financial, whether it's transportation, whether it's to really determine what are the objections to donating, so that we can then provide the appropriate solution. In the report that was put together, I referenced earlier. It was put together by some graduate students at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs. This was just kind of an initial preview, and they recommended six possible solutions. And this really would be the foundation of this task force, and they would expand on it to look at it more in depth. They suggested a possible surplus agricultural product purchase program, either by the state or by private funds, perhaps. Tax credits, gleaning, which was referenced, direct donations just on behalf or just on a goodwill basis by the growers, some funding for processing for donations, and taking product that's in a one format and they perhaps repackaging it or making it into another format. So, for example, taking fresh apples and making it into apple cider that has a longer shelf life. So those were just some of their six initial recommendations. We'd like to be able to take a look, get all the stakeholders together and look at it in depth to find out what the objections are and which of these tools or other tools it will take to increase the donations from our Minnesota farmers and growers.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Mr. Manns, is this bringing all the stakeholders together, and there's, 16 or so on the list here?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason that amongst the 16 or so that couldn't be done without us writing this into statute and creating another piece of government? I see the University of Minnesota Extension on there. I know they're very good at facilitating this type of discussion and organizing meetings with groups like yours. I can't see why this group couldn't do this without us writing this into law.
And Madam Chair, maybe I can help with that a little bit too. I always think, again, a minimal cost task force like this, if the commissioner is officially appointing people, number one, they're more likely to participate and show up than Second Harvest calling to, hey, would you come on down for a meeting? I mean, this will be a very structured thing. But I think secondarily, and maybe more importantly, as he talked, if you have an official group like this, it's really a conduit back through the commissioner then and to us, for example, the Downer Animals. maybe there is a way, if it's illegal to harvest those animals or that livestock at a USDA facility right now, perhaps a locally inspected USDA facility can legally do it. And if there's a stumbling block within statute, then we can correct that. So I think a lot of it is, as they said, is looking at state statutes on food handling and other things and discovering if there's ways we can tweak the law at no cost to allow some of these things to happen. And I've found in the past it's much easier if you have the commissioner participating with a group of appointees who then become the conduit back through the government rather than just ad hoc committees meeting on their own and then trying to discover who's going to carry this for them and who's going to, you know, bring it forth to the legislature, etc. So some structure, although minimal, I think is required sometimes to accomplish some of this. At least that's been my experience.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Junkie, I guess I would just offer that there's no reason Department of Ag couldn't be one of the groups on this list, too, if it was done in the private sector. We continue to see again and again, government continues to be built here, different structures and organizations. We're in a $6.4 billion deficit, and in the biennium after this one, we're looking at another $5 billion in deficit. All these little things add up, and we've got to encourage the goodwill, in this case, I think, of the private sector. They certainly have the ability to do these things, and I don't know why we have to do this.
Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I almost got my name changed.
Just about.
All right. Almost be as lucky as Dreskowski. So, Representative Junkie, the report is due in February 1st of 2010 in this bill, and yet it would remain active until June 30th of 2011. Do you foresee any reason why that once the report is in, will we need to continue funding a program once their task force report has come in?
Madam Chair and Representative Shemansky, I guess I'll have to think through that. Again, I got this language from Senator Vickerman. I'm not sure why he established it that way, but certainly if there's no reason to continue it once they do their report, I guess that would be, to me it wouldn't matter one way or another, but I'm not sure why it's that way. I'd have to check with the drafters and why they set it up that way, because I'm not sure, and I don't know that our research understands that either at this point. It was, I think, drafted over in the Senate. But I'll certainly look into it, and again, these task force members are serving at no cost, so there wouldn't be additional cost other than they continue for another six months, but or 5 months from February.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, just making sure in your response to Representative Dreskowski's question, Representative Junkie, if I could kind of summarize, tell me if I'm wrong here. So the reason for doing it this way is to make it more visible, to give it more validity, and to make sure that it happens.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I would think that would certainly be one of the main reasons.
Thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think it's been my time this session on Gene Pawlowski's committee that reminds me. Representative Junkie, will you be hearing the fiscal aspects of this bill in the Finance Committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other testifiers? If not, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 1886 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Members will be taking up House File 1447, and while the author is making her way to the chair, I will move House File 1447, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Madam Chair, are you ready to explain the bill?
Yes, I am.
Proceed.
Was it moved? I probably didn't hear you.
The bill's been moved.
Okay. This is a veterinarian student loan bill. This would create a new program to pay down the student loans of veterinarians that graduate for or attend to you. And they must practice in underserved rural areas. We know that a lot of students are actually becoming veterinarians, but they're not coming back to the rural area. And we're hoping that with a student loan, we would have students coming back to us in our rural area. So.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And so you have testifiers. Is the dean going to take it from here, or?
That's correct.
No, I'm not.
Dean Ames, would you identify yourself for the tape, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Trevor Ames. I'm the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, and I want to thank you and the committee members for this opportunity to discuss this topic. I appreciate the introduction of this bill and can say on behalf of our students wanting to go back into rural areas, they appreciate it as well. The college is committed to training veterinarians that will contribute to Minnesota's economy, and certainly, as this committee is well aware, agriculture is a big part of the state's economy. Our goal is really to have the best possible education to meet the needs of Minnesota and to protect animal health and the health of the citizens as well. The profession is really one that sort of bridges animal health and human health and seems to be one that is continually changing. We do believe that by protecting animal health, we're also protecting the state's economy and the livestock industry, and we're also ensuring a safer food supply. And through those two methods, we're helping ensure the public health of the state as well.
Excuse me, Dean Ames. Representative Riddall, you had a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, we didn't have to do it that quick, but since you call all this to ask this question now, and I probably should know the answer to this, but when you get a degree in veterinary, is it small animal, large animal, are they two separate degrees? So a guy who does a cat could do a cow.
Yes, it's currently it's really the licensure that is a single licensure. There's no limited accreditation or limited licensure or species-specific licensure. This slide references a publication that was produced by the American Veterinary Medical Association and is included in your folders. And basically what it's saying is that there are 28 veterinary colleges in the United States serving the nation. And at the time of this publication, there were about 2,500 graduates a year. Currently, there's about 2,800 that are being produced to meet the needs of the country. an equally large concern is that many of the veterinarians that work in government agencies are within 5 to 10 years of retirement. And in many rural areas, we see a high percentage of veterinarians that are also approaching retirement age. Within our veterinary class, we've seen students, partly in relation to their debt load, choosing maybe more lucrative careers in small animal practice, and we've seen a drop in the number of students going into rural practice and food animal practice over the last 10 years, almost approaching 50%. The American Veterinary Medical Association has generated a website that actually looks at the number of veterinarians per county and correlates that with the number of animals in those counties. And within Minnesota, there are four counties that have over 25,000 animals that have no veterinarians. There are 10 counties with no veterinarians that have between 5,000 and 25,000 animals. And then there are four counties with no veterinarians but around 5,000 animals. So we end up with, in the state of Minnesota, approaching 9 million food animals, which includes poultry, and only about 400 food animal veterinarians taking care of that specific need. This slide is in your packet, and it actually breaks it down by county, showing the counties with high food animal numbers and low veterinary numbers, so that you can see the counties that are especially problematic. In addition to veterinarians taking care of food animals, there's also a growing role for what are called public health veterinarians. These veterinarians, their role has grown in importance in response to the issues listed on the slide, especially those that involve the transmission of disease from animals to man. This growing importance of public health veterinarians is especially true because of the growing national shortage for these veterinarians in USDA, the United States Public Health Service, the Armed Forces, as well as many state agencies. And it's good to point out at this time that the veterinary school has partnered with the School of Public Health to create a combined degree program for students to get both a DDM and a Master's of Public Health in 4 years. And currently, we are training more veterinarians, public health veterinarians, than all the other veterinary schools in the nation combined. This slide just gives you a perspective of the educational costs. So these costs for the College of Veterinary Medicine to educate a veterinary student are $2,006, but they show you that it costs about over $200,000 to train a veterinarian, over $43,000 to train a master's student, $81,000 to train a PhD student, and an MPH student is around $80,000. Our students' in-state tuition is $22,000, out-of-state is $41,000. And the average indebtedness is about $130,000 when they graduate. And then the starting salaries are also shown on this slide, with the significant differential shown between small animal and large animal of about $18,000. It's important to point out that there's a very significant shortage of veterinarians going into small animal practice as well. And Banfield Hospitals, which is the largest employers of veterinarians in the nation with about 700 hospitals, are stating that there is a very significant shortage. In addition, the Bureau of Labor Statistics also recognizes this shortage and rates the veterinary medicine as a very rapidly growing profession. And the shortage of small animal veterinarians is really one that has an effect across the profession, and it's important that the college and the state understand that so long as those shortages exist, it will affect our ability to place veterinarians into food animal practice, public health, etc., as we've been discussing. Minnesota has about 80% of the veterinarians in the state were trained at the veterinary college. Last year, we had 1,100 applicants for 90 positions. And so we certainly have a good applicant pool. It's one of the larger ones in the nation. We do allow some degree of specialization to respond to Representative Erdahl's question. In the last 2 years of the curriculum, especially in the last year, and we have what we call tracks, And so we have five different career tracks. Food ammo is one of those tracks. So the students still have to pass a common national board. But having passed that board, they can use their specialization to focus in certain areas. And we do believe that proper training in food ammo areas is one of the things that allows them to succeed and persist in a rural community. Our students have a great degree of flexibility in their senior year. They can choose 29 different two-week senior rotations out of a possible 65 that we offer. So if they are interested in dairy, or they are interested in swine, or they're interested in poultry, they can take a significant amount of specialization to let them go out into these industries and succeed. There was a national task force that sort of looked at what is needed to really get students back into these areas, and they broke it down into recruiting, mentoring, incentives, and proper preparation and educational background. And so I'll try and talk a little bit about what we're doing in those areas. In terms of admissions, we've changed our selection process, so not only do we use we have 1,100 applicants, so we have plenty of smart students applying. The average GPA for our class is about 3.65. But the GPA really just gets them across the first hurdle, and then we use a very extensive behavioral interview that selects for attributes that have been shown to predict success in the profession. So we try to get students with the right personal attributes so that they can go into communities and succeed. We've developed an early admission, early decision process in conjunction with the College of Agriculture. So in the freshman year, students can apply to get into veterinary school. We'll give them provisional acceptance at the end of the freshman year. They have to do mentored experiences in their pre-vet summers as well as in their first two summers in vet school in a food animal industry and in a food animal practice. And we're currently seeing a good applicant pool with someplace around 10 to 12 students, up as high as 15 in some years, in both the sophomore and junior class of agriculture as well as in all years of the vet school. We have a goal of having 20 of those students a year, so we continue to push the College of Agriculture to help us have more of those students. And this program, so far that we graduated our first few last spring, and they were in the top 10% of their class, so we're certainly attracting good students. It's been successful in pulling students out of rural communities, so rural farm kids can see a way to get into agriculture, get into vet school, and get both degrees in 7 years, and so it's been good in terms of attracting those kids. And the one predictor about whether students will go back into a rural community is if they came from a rural community. I've already talked about what we're doing to train public health professionals in the combined degree program, and we have a strong emphasis on what we call experiential education. And from the time they walk in the door in their freshman year, they're getting a lot of hands-on experience, so they're comfortable working around animals. We also do a lot of leadership training so that these students can go out into communities and be community leaders. We have an extensive off-site orientation program, as well as we continue to train them in what are called professional skills, communication, problem solving, emotional resilience, etc. We have some pretty unique educational programs for our food animal students. We have a dairy teaching farm, a swine teaching farm, a small ruminant teaching farm, and a rural equine practice. And, of course, our veterinary diagnostic lab is a vital component of training food animal students, as well as a vital part of supporting the agricultural industry in the state. And I think that this financial loan forgiveness incentive that is being proposed today is being offered by Representative Otremba is kind of the capstone on what we're doing to recruit, mentor, adequately train, and provide financial incentives for these students to go into underserved areas. We also have scholarship programs, and it is interesting that many retired veterinarians want to set up scholarships for students in the VetFast program. So in closing, I think some things to consider that I think that these incentives will definitely help attract students to go into these underserved areas. I think the way it's set up, the maximum payout for students would be if they stayed in community for 5 years. These national studies that I've referred to have shown that if a veterinarian stays and works in a rural community for more than 5 years, that they have a much, much greater likelihood of staying in that community for their career, and also they have some of the highest job satisfaction in the profession. Some of the neighboring states, North Dakota and Wisconsin, are in the process of passing legislation, or in the case of North Dakota, have passed legislation to have loan forgiveness. So we certainly would like to keep our well-trained students in the state of Minnesota. And veterinary medicine is currently the only healthcare profession that doesn't have a loan forgiveness program, although USDA will be starting to administer a program, and they may be nationally administering a program that has up to about $700,000 a year for the nation to deal with loan forgiveness. So I just conclude by thanking you for your support of the college and your consideration of this bill. And we certainly take it as our responsibility to train veterinarians to meet the needs of society and meet the needs of agriculture. And we hope that you can consider supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Ames. We have a short list going here. Representative Chmielewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dean Ames, a couple of questions, but probably the last one first. You'd mentioned about the loan forgiveness program and so forth. And is there going to be any mean testing? In other words, if a veterinarian leaves school and joins a practice, let's say with a father or something, and, you know, is he still going to be eligible for the loan forgiveness going out into a rural area, otherwise qualifying, as we will?
If he's got the loans, or she, and it's more and more likely that it's a she, then I think that they would be eligible for the program. They can only get loan forgiveness up to the amount of their loans, and they so they have to be able to demonstrate that they have the loans, and they have to be able to demonstrate that they're in an underserved area, and they have to be able to demonstrate that at least 50% of the time or greater they're servicing food animals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over the weekend, I had an opportunity to talk to a couple of your veterinary students and these young ladies. When I mentioned the concept of this bill, they were pretty excited about it, that they would have the opportunity to, and they wanted to go into large animal practice and serve the rural area. So I think this is a very good idea, and I encourage you to carry forward.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate the intent of the bill, and but I do have a couple questions. First of all, what success are the other states that are doing this having? Have they seen a significant increase in the number of veterinarians and working in large animals in out states?
It's pretty new. I think North Dakota has been in place for a couple of years, so I can't give you statistics on these other states. I can certainly tell you that I've written letters for some of the North Dakota students that we've trained that are going back to North Dakota, so they're certainly taking advantage of this. But so we have a contract with the Dakotas and Nebraska to train their students, and so certainly the North Dakotans that I'm aware of are taking advantage of this to go back into the rural communities.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question is, why are we only looking at 50% has to be dedicated to large animals? If there's as much of a shortage as it sounds like there is out there, couldn't we push that to 75 or even 90%?
A lot of veterinarians that work in rural communities are able to supplement the income they make from working on large animals by also taking care of companion animals in that community. And it would be somewhat hard for them to be in a rural community and not provide full service veterinary care to that community. So that was the number that when I started having discussions with Senator Dill about this many months ago, that we recommended.
Okay. Last question, thank you. What is the average starting pay for a veterinarian today?
In small animal, it's about $80,000, and in large animal, it's about $62,000. If they go into exclusive food animal practice, working in strictly a swine practice or strictly a poultry practice, those are good jobs and more in line with the small animal. But if they go into a rural area working on as a mixed practitioner with an emphasis on food animals, those tend to be the lower salaries.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Otremba, I think you'll like this. I was invited to the University of Minnesota to speak to the pre-vet club. And out of this stems from a comment that was made about possibly she other than he, you know, as far as your veterinarian. There were 70 students, Representative Otremba, and only two were male. So I figured you'd get a kick out of that.
Our freshman class, Mr. Chair, has 25% males. So.
Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question would be for either Representative Otremba or Mr. Ames. I guess I'm on page 3, lines 3.4, 3.5, 3.6. The sentence says, the commissioner must allow waivers of all or part of the money owed the commissioner as a result of non-fulfillment penalty if emergency circumstances prevented fulfillment of the service obligation. It seems very broad and very open to being exercised, if you will. Have you thought of alternative language there, something that is more definitive, or maybe even striking it out?
Yeah, certainly that was intended to really deal with medical emergencies. You know, if somebody was disabled and wasn't able to continue to practice, so that was really the intent of it. So I would defer to Representative Otremba if there's better language.
Do you have an idea?
Colby?
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, on page 1, lines 15 through 17, the term emergency circumstances is defined to include death, total and permanent disability, or temporary disability lasting more than 2 years.
Thank you.
And Colby, that's in statute?
Mr. Chair, that's in the bill as proposed.
In the bill as proposed. Representative Schmancy.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, maybe Colby can answer this, but as I read listened to Representative Drazkowski's question, I thought, what if this veterinary student was also a member of a military branch, National Guard or ROTC or something? Could we incorporate that, not necessarily as an emergency, but should we make an exception for that? I guess I'm just asking the question.
Colby.
Mr. Chair and members, I mean, if that is the will of the committee, I think that should be amended to say that expressly. Right now it reads that emergency circumstances means those conditions that make it impossible, and then it's including starts the list of death, total, and permanent disability. So, you know, if it was adopted as is, the Department of Agriculture would make that kind of determination without more direction from the legislature.
Again, I think I would ask this to Colby. Current legislation regarding serving servicemen and women coming back only refers to jobs, probably, and not to a loan forgiveness program like this. So we would have to put something in here to cover that. Is that what you would?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to check with my colleague Jim Cleary, who's not here today, who is the expert in that area. But I think you're probably correct. Yeah.
Anything further while this testifier is in front of us? We have another testifier, as I understand it, for this bill. Yes, Tom Haggerty from the Veterinarians Association, correct? Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the tape and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Haggerty. I'm a veterinarian, and I'm representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, And I'll only say that we strongly support this idea of a loan forgiveness program. As long as I've been in the business, I've hired many, many, many veterinarians. And the interesting thing to me is, years ago, they would come out with a reasonably small loan. And today they come out with what I think is shocking. In fact, it almost makes me wonder why they want to be in this business. And when you're in, you do all right if you're in a practice that is very busy and has a lot of animals. But when you get into the more rural areas or the underserved areas, those veterinarians that are out there today, and many of them are like me, still working, but they want to get out of there and just cannot get somebody to come out. Just can't even give them a practice. They just can't make enough calls in a day to service that debt. So we strongly support the idea of a loan forgiveness program.
Thank you. Members, any questions, comments? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 1447 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? The motion prevails. We are now moving on to House File 1579. And members, in order to get this in front of us legally, I am going to move House File 1579 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. But I want to announce at the onset here that we'll be laying this bill over for future consideration, and I would ask our committee administrator to explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to explain, Representative Otremba and I received concerns from the pet food industry earlier this morning that they weren't content with the language that the department has to keep their recipes non-public, so we're going to lay this bill over and see if there's a way we can address the issue without having them give the recipes over to the department.
Now we understand. Madam Chair, proceed with your explanation.
Are we actually going to do it today?
We'll take the testimony. I think we have people that are here ready to speak.
Then I have to go get the other stuff. I thought it
was... We can deliver here.
This is the first file. That's everything I didn't bring with me, so...
Well, I will be brief because we really didn't have any knowledge that other people were wanting to be a part of our bill. So that's one of the reasons that we are not going to go forward with. Basically, this is one of my constituents, and one of the and I think all of you probably have what I call she was going to come today, and then we had all this water and whatever problems, so she couldn't come, and so I don't know if you have that in your packet.
Members, this is in reference to the email that you should have in your packets.
And I don't have that here. Anyway, I just give you a sort of a synopsis. She lost her job, so she went on to do puppy food, so to speak. And she went through the Department of Ag and did all the right things, and except that she was only making about, I think it was $2,000, and her fees were like $3,000. And so we thought that, she thought that because her recipes were the same, And so she didn't think that that was right, that she would have to pay fees for all of those, even though the fact that they were actually one recipe. So that's sort of the thing that we're dealing with. And so I think I've talked to several people, and I think there's some I think there's some of that stuff that we thought we're going to do something, but when we both sat down, we knew that both of them need to be, we had to do something different. So that's kind of what's happening with this. And it's about someone that it's jobs, and it's somebody that's, you know, going out and doing all this thing, and then having so many fees that it doesn't even make sense to even be making these types of foods for your dog. So we have some things to get done in the next couple of days, but I think we can do it. I think it's admirable for her to have she got lost her job. She started out and did some things that were really good, and but the fees were higher than what her dollar amounts were. So I'll let other people do some testimonies if they want to, or if you want to look later or whatever. But that's the gist of the bill, and we just have to clear it up and figure out how to make her have a lot of money.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there are any people that want to testify, get something on record today, given the current status of the bill, we'd welcome you.
And I think if I would have heard from people earlier, because we did have it posted for 5 days, and I was not getting the information. The information had been given to my constituents, and they were sort of not, and so they were upset because some people were calling them, and it should have been us, and I didn't know that was happening, and so we could have had this done, but we will have it done.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Okay. My name is Chuck Orvick. I'm here representing Tuffy's Pet Foods, which is a Minnesota-based pet food manufacturer. And having just heard these comments, I perhaps will change a little bit what I have to say, but I did prepare something, and I believe all of you have written information from our company. Our concern is specifically about the wording in House File 1579 that refers to recipes. Recipes are vital, important, and they're the heart of the pet food business. My job at Tuffy's Pet Foods is to develop and maintain those recipes. I've got 32 years experience in the pet food business, and I would hate to think that anyone had access to those recipes outside of our company. So it's the word recipe and the precise amount of wording in the house file that we were very, very concerned about. I would suggest that having a pet food company register its recipes is no different than asking Coca-Cola to register its secret syrup recipes, or Kentucky Fried Chicken to register its secret 13 herbs and spices recipes. They're vital. That's the lifeblood of the business. The language in the bill that declares that recipes will be treated as trade secret, non-public data, doesn't mitigate our concerns that these recipes might slip out. The disclosure of proprietary information today is happening often and often and often. We see that in the news media. There's a lot of high-profile instances of that, hacked information, stolen information. We would not like our recipes that we have years and years and years of investment into being the subject of hacked information or public disclosure. The other thing that we note is that the House File 1579 does not seem to provide direction for the Department of Agriculture on the use of that recipe information. We don't think that there's a state need for this information. We think that disclosure could be damaging to a vital industry in Minnesota and damaging to the pet food industry, which is a very large industry nationally. We just don't think that the
Minnesota Department of Agriculture should be responsible for collecting and treating its trade secret recipe information. I would note, and I can answer questions to this point, that current Minnesota regulations of pet foods provide numerous assurances for the purchasers of pet food. These regulations cover a guaranteed analysis statement that's on every bag of pet food, an ingredient listing in descending order by order of weight of inclusion in the pet food, statements of nutritional adequacy, and they're backed by detailed nutritional specs. So I'm urging that the recipe content of that bill be rethought and reworked. Now, I'd be open to questions if someone has some on perhaps regulation or oversight of the pet food business. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tremble. You have a comment?
I think we know for sure that we don't want our recipes out anywhere either. So I think as we were talking earlier today, we know that that's a sore spot for all of us. And so that's one of the first things that we're going to look at, because nobody wants to have anybody else's.
No.
So that
we are. And we are content with the current rules for registration of products. We supply all of that registration information to the state of Minnesota and to every other state in which we do business, which includes 49 other states. We don't have any problem with that. We understand the FDA's oversight and rules that govern the pet food business. We understand the implications of the Food and Drug Administration's Amendments Act of 2007 and how that bears on the regulation of pet food and things like ingredient disclosures and that, and it doesn't bring up recipes. So if you have any questions that I can help you with?
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just a quick question. If it wasn't consistent, if the law wasn't consistent between the states, could interstate sales be restricted?
That's a good question. But perhaps not. The pet food business is so very big that our company chooses to go through the registration procedure in every one of the states. And every one of the states has slight nuances. The business is important enough that we would take that on. So I would suggest that probably wouldn't. It would be very, very nice from the standpoint of our company and the people in our industry if the states had similar or the same registration information. They don't. We look forward to the possibility of there being greater FDA oversight of our industry and that streamlining perhaps the business of registration and the AFCO, that's the Association of American Feed Control Officials, who set up a model bill that Minnesota has adopted for its regulations.
And I hope that all of you read her story, because it's an interesting piece. And we know that there's probably other people out there that are doing small things, because they're going through labs and everything, but the fees are higher than what she's making, and so we have a little bit to work for.
And I can understand how a individual business person might look at that, but sometimes you have to pay the fees in order to get into the business at a certain level of.
Well, I think she's doing that, but when you look at 1 ounce packages and 3 ounce packages and 6 ounce packages, and they're all that's a pretty small. There's some of these things have to change.
And we would be quite happy if the rules were changed to register by product, not by product and size, because we register every product in every size and pay a fee for every product in every size. And I haven't read that, but I think what's being suggested is that there would be one registration fee for product, whether it's in 1 ounce or 3 ounce or 5 ounce or 10 ounce packages. We would very much like that.
That seemed to be the gist of this. So members, we're going to have to vacate this room very soon, and I would like to know if there's anybody else that would like to testify on this bill, considering that we are laying it over. And I do see one person coming forward here. And while he's coming down, Representative Discalzi has a very fast question, right?
Thank you, Chair Doty. Just wondering, listen to this. Obviously, the fee is the impediment here. Is there, and I really feel for this gal in trying to get this business going, Representative Otremba. If we could find a way to reduce the fee or make it a one-time rather than annual fee so we can cut those in half, or maybe have some sort of business size threshold under which you wouldn't need to pay the fee, some sort of creative things like that. Obviously, the cost of government is getting in the way of these businesses succeeding.
And she's following the laws, and if you read it, they're all, almost everybody else around her isn't because of the fee, so they're not going through.
So hopefully that'll be one of the things that we'll consider as this bill is in progress. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We represent grain elevators and feed mills in the state. I would concur with the discussion that recipes was our concern. I'd be happy to work with the department on the fees. I'm sure we could come up with a fee structure that would address her concerns, because you know, she should be allowed to operate. I don't think that's a big issue for our industry. Just wanted to get on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this? Representative Hamilton.
Just one more comment. I'm just wondering if the department, if we didn't change those recipes, would we be exposing the state to liabilities of maintaining that confidentiality of the industry's recipes? So that might be a legal issue there as well that we'll want to take into consideration.
We're looking at that too.
Thank you. Anyone else need to testify on this bill? Seeing none, this bill will be laid over for future consideration, and we are adjourned.